members present are Representative Kawasaki, Representative Roses, Representative Wilson, welcome, Representative Gatto, Representative Gutenberg, and Representative Edgman. And also let the record reflect that Representative Corrigan is excused, and Representative Seaton will be along shortly. He has another meeting. First of all, I'd like for everyone to make sure they have their cell phones turned off as a housekeeping measure. Thank you, Representative Gatto, for doing that. The purpose of this meeting today, we're going to take up House Bill 87 and then HB 25. Representative Kelly has a finance meeting, so we're going to take these in reverse order. Before we get started, though, I do want to take a second as a privilege of the chair and recognize that we are in the Ramona Barnes Resource Room, and I don't know of any of you who had an opportunity to work with her, the stories you've heard, and I assure you they're probably true. But one thing that if you talk to 60 members of the body and other members of the public, depending on how many people you talk to, you'd come up with that many different opinions. But I think the one thing that everyone would agree on is that Ramona loved this state, loved this institution, and was a real believer in responsible resource development. And I personally am honored to get to look at her picture. I did have the ability to work with her, and hopefully we can rise to that level of professionalism and reflect well on her past. And with that, that's all I have. Representative Kelly, would you like to begin? Also, let the record show that Representative Seaton is present.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for getting us up to bat here so we can make it to the Finance Committee meeting. Sue will be carrying the water on this, but I'd like to mention that we want to stand back up the Citizens Advisory Council on Federal Areas. It is something that served us well when it was in place, and I think as someone who roams about Alaska quite a bit and am an outdoorsman, hunt, fish, fly, trap, you name it, out there at various times, there are folks out there that run into problems with the federal government on the land. And in the past, when CACFA, as the Citizens Advisory Council is called, was in place, they had an effective way to communicate with their state about what was going on out there and to get help where it was appropriate. In the current situation, they go directly through an appeal or fix the squawks process that is strictly on the Fed side. It doesn't work very well, and I've been involved in several incidents where I think CACFA would be the perfect thing to put back in place. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I might, Representative Stu, or Representative, not yet, but my staffer, Sue Stancliffe, more familiar to most of you than I am. So, Sue, if you could.
Mr. President, I understand that you need to leave fairly quick. Will you stick around for a little bit?
I would love to stick around, so I will until I have to go, if I might.
And maybe this would be a good time. Does anyone have any questions of the sponsor prior to him having to sneak out in advance? Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kelly. Could you give us some examples of how this worked previous? Both good and bad, how it worked successfully and how it didn't work?
Well, I think it worked successfully as a way for citizens to find a body, a board, a commission to come before and to speak about the problems that they were having. You know, whether that was we've got some problems up in our area with some of the folks that have trapped north of the Yukon for years that have just been having fits over the changes that have in the way the different refuge managers manage the situation, from complete leave them alone, let them do what they've been doing for 100 years, to micromanagement. You know, this is where you can park your truck, nowhere else. This is what we want you to do relative to how you run the operation. The two guides with different situations. People, for example, that I'm familiar with that have been on the land since before it was turned into to federal management areas. that just have all kinds of difficulties. So the way this worked well was to get everyday people to listen to their problems and then try to help them out. Now they're alone. That's the bottom line now, is they're alone. And when they talk to folks like us, we're not connected. We're just individual legislators that hear the problem, and we don't get the thing in front of an official panel that actually can have some effect. So those are the things that I see that it once did and now is unable to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, why was it disbanded to begin with? Can you give us a little history there?
It was Governor Knowles that defunded it, and it pretty well collapsed then. And I don't want to put words in his mouth or thoughts in his head. I think he and I see most of the things that happen outside the city limits differently. So I don't want to inject guess at why he did it. But he was the one responsible for decommissioning it. And I think it's had a negative effect out there. It advantages the Fed over our citizens, and I don't think that was what I heard in the promises that I heard back during ANILCA. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple questions. The first was the local fish and game advisory committees. How did that previously, did they interact with this commission, and do you anticipate that they will kind of integrate their activities, or are they totally separate?
This is mostly about what the Fed does in the management of these conservation units and ties over to that, but Representative Seaton, I'll tell you what, I'll make my exit now, and it sounds like Sue can answer that, so we'll do it.
Okay. I did have just one other, and that was, we have a new system on federal, and that is the federal subsistence, mm-hmm. and federal subsistence advisory boards and all those. Would this interact, or would this take the place of, or would this consider federal subsistence actions?
This would, just like with the advisory boards, the game. Boards, this would interact with them and have access to them as part of its ability to work with and problem solve. That's not prevented.
Follow up?
Sure.
So I'm just trying to figure out. So this advisory commission would also have federal subsistence regulations as one of their federal activities that they would have purview over?
As to how that touches down in a particular unit, then that would be the case. I mean, in other words, someone could generate a complaint or a difficulty, a challenge that they're having, and this advisory commission then would be able to try to work this out, whether it's, regardless of who is in control in that particular area. So it has the power to do that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative, it says in the title, an act reestablishing, and I understand what that means, which, as you said, then Governor Knowles dissolved the commission. Mm-hmm. On the last page, you have commission members. My guess is all those members dissolved with the dissolution of the committee. So the fact that we have these names here, is there some connection between these names that were on the previous committee and recommendations for a new committee?
No. In fact, we have online with us today a previous commission member, Mr. Ackles, who is hooked up to listen or to testify I'm not sure if he intends to testify or if he's here for questions, but we have a previous commission member in Dell Ackles who was experienced with the commission and on it for some period of time. But the answer is no. Those names just represent the folks that were there, and although some of them might be good candidates, there is no attempt by us in the bill to influence how what the makeup's going to be.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would assume then, under this act, that I believe commission members would receive $400 a day per diem and $400 a day during travel, as well as travel expenses. And because the fiscal note indicated undisclosed, unknown, or not known, that would be part of it. In the fiscal note, that's what we would see. No salaries, no retirement, but simply the per diem and the travel expenses.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Sue Stancliffe for the record, staff to Representative Kelly. The commission members are subject to the per diem and travel reimbursements.
But not the PERS TERS.
But not PERS TERS, no. No.
Any other questions for the representative before Griffin?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thank Representative Gatto for pointing out their previous commission members. Looking at the commission members and then looking at the qualification for members on page 2, section lines 11 through 14, representative diversity of uses on federal and state land. It doesn't look like to me that the group of previous commission members represented a very broad spectrum across the state.
You can't speak for prior legislation.
It looked like they were from certainly not urban members from the state, but all Fairbanks, Anchorage, Soldotna, you know, federal lands were all over, but they looked like more outside of the Chitna, looked like all urban members.
And your question about how it might be formed in the future?
Well, yeah. I mean, I support and I like the diversity of users, but I'm wondering, it's diversity of users are not how it's defined by the previous commission members. It looks right. Like it's urban.
I can't comment on that, Mr. Chairman, only because I don't, you know, there are a lot of those people I don't know.
It's up to the governor also.
Yeah, it'd be up to the governor and the legislature to construct, you know, make the members reflect an appropriate balance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions for the representative?
Through the chair. I have several questions, but I will wait until after Ms. Stancliffe presents, because she may answer those her remarks are going to be.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just going back to Representative Guttenberg's comments, page 2, line 13, specifically part E, who are not members of the legislature. There must be some reason why we don't want them to be members of the legislature, and yet the commission members, I think I counted 3, who were certainly past members of the legislature. Can you comment a little bit on the desire to avoid members of the legislature that are currently serving, but to allow members of the legislature that no longer serve?
Well, I can only
Line 6 through 8.
Right. What I have is just an opinion on that, Representative Gatto, but my opinion would be that it's like a lot of things, the desire to keep the legislators out of that advisory commission at a time when they're, you know, in the state.
No.
Again, Sue maybe do a lot better job than I on that one. But so I'm just hazarding a guess as to how it's constructed. It'd be the same comment as I made with Representative Gatto.
I think she's got the answer.
Yeah. So if that's the case, Mr. Chairman, I think I will exit stage right before I get myself in trouble.
thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Mike. Can you take that back over there?
Line page 10.
For the record, members of the committee, my name is Sue Stancliffe, again, staff to Representative Kelly. In quick response to Representative Gatto's answer, page 2, lines 6 through 8, E, the President of the Senate shall appoint 2 members from the membership of the State Senate, and then the House, the Speaker of the House will appoint 2 members from the House. That's how those board members or those commission members are placed on there. And with that, Mr. Chairman, if I could go back to the introduction of the bill, and I appreciate the leeway to let the representative answer questions first so he could attend the Finance Committee meeting. A little bit of history. And first, let me say thank you for recognizing that this is the Ramona Barnes Room, because She was a large advocate of CACFA and very instrumental in keeping it going and keeping it very, very active. The Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas was established originally in 1981 by the Alaska State Legislature to provide assistance to the citizens of Alaska who are affected by the management of federal lands within the state. The commission was first, it was repealed in 1998 after Governor Knowles removed the funding, even though the legislature had approved the sunset through 2003. HB 87 is a little bit different from the original legislation, or as it was before it was repealed, in that we removed the sunset, and we also want to take the notion away that it was a temporary commission. We don't want it to be a temporary commission because these issues are going to be ongoing for decades to come. So we removed the sunset and are putting it in as a permanent fixture. The need for the commission arose primarily from the passage of the Alaska Native or National Interest Lands Conservation Act, as we all know as ANILCA, in 1980. The changes in land status which resulted from the creation and expansion of conservation system units increased the potential for conflict between Alaskans' traditional uses of these federal lands and the mandates in ANILCA. The commission is charged with the responsibility of researching issues and determining the impact of federal statutes, regulations, and management decisions on the citizens of Alaska in order to minimize or resolve potential conflicts. The commission had been very effective in assuring that the land management decisions are consistent with both statutory language and congressional intent, and in protecting the interest of Alaska citizens, that being, of course, the primary goal. It was the intent of the 12th legislature who first established the CACFA that the commissioners should be Alaskans directly affected and impacted by the establishment, the operation, and the management of federal lands in Alaska. The Senate Resources Committee back in 81 adopted intent language with the conception of this, stating that what their desires were, and the paragraph that I read just prior to that is from that intent language, and further states that to achieve this objective, it was believed that the commissioners of the Citizens Advisory Commission should not be state officials such as commissioners or the department's top staff. Further intent stated that the governor, Speaker of the House, and President of the Senate appoint non-governmental related persons to the maximum extent possible. The bill is drafted in Title 41. I've gone back and forth looking at that. Just because it was there previously doesn't mean that that's where it has to go back, but in looking at it, reviewing the fiscal portions of it, came to the conclusion that this is exactly where it needs to be. It's Title 41 is titled Public Resources, and we believe strongly that that's where it should be. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll entertain any questions that you might have. And if I could just point out one thing, is that in the packet for your information, and it was for information purposes only, I included the 1997 annual report, which is what was being referred to as far as the commissioners that served previously. But this will give you an idea of what they do, what they did, who was there, the decisions they made, et cetera.
Commissioner Roses? Thank you. Through the chair. Ms. Stancliffe, could you, I mean, there's no documentation to support it, so could you give me some idea of some of the issues that have been brought forward to you that they would lead you to believe that we need to reinstate this since
Certainly.
We haven't had it since 99?
Absolutely, no problem. Just in our office alone, and I will speak only to our office, is several state and federal land issues regarding mining, trapping, fishing, and hunting, all of those, even just recreating on the Nowitna River, that people have brought to us where they have had federal issues, federal officials, I'll refrain from calling them bureaucrats, but federal officials that have made statements to them or harassed them in a way of, you know, that they've actually left their trap lines or removed themselves from the area because of the level of harassment. One case was taken to court and won, but that didn't stop the feds. They continued and continued and continued. And we're dealing right now with a hopefully a model case for a group that is relating to a mining claim in the 40-mile area, where they have to, they have an RS-2477 that crosses a section of the scenic wild and, you know, wild and scenic corridor. They have an RS-2477 that goes all the way up to that, but doesn't provide access across it. That's just, you know, another one that we have. We've heard from several other offices, and the biggest thing that we're hearing is if we just had someone that can advocate for the public, because otherwise they come to our offices and we don't have the expertise level to be able to manage their cases and relate them to state and federal law. State law, no problem. We can intercede, no problem. But the federal law is very difficult and complex.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sue, I've just got a question here, and that's about the makeup of the committee.
Uh-huh.
I see who's going to do the appointing, but I do have a concern. Would there be an objection if we looked at this in a way so that there was a balance to it, so that there were rural or urban people on that committee?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I believe that it does address that,
okay,
in my opinion, in the statute where it says the qualifications, because we are to consider the diversity of the users. And the diversity of the users come from statewide.
Well, follow up?
Yes, ma'am.
It does, you know, possibly maybe that there were a lot of these people on here that used to be rural people and maybe that now are living in the city. Maybe that's why. But just at a quick glance, it looks like that there's a lot of them from the cities and not very much from the rural areas. But that is a possibility, I guess.
It certainly is. And the former members of the commission were probably more representative. I don't know the answer specific. I'm sure Dell Ackles can answer that question. But what I would state is, because looking at the members in the Fairbanks list, they have connections north of Fairbanks. And like Representative Kelly stated, you know, he hunts and fishes clear up into up the Nowitna, way up into the northern part of the state, into the Nowitna Refuge. And so a number of these people do the same thing. And so even though they're living in Fairbanks, they're representative of the northern portion of the state, if I could argue that. But I'm sure that Mr. Ackles could probably answer that.
Thank you.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. It's just a technical question. I have the statute in front of me. And the statute goes 41.35.380 on another subject. And I was looking for 41.37, which was referenced in the bill.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, Chapter 37, Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas in Alaska. And then it begins bracketing and lots of squirrely statements. And it says, repealed,
mm-hmm,
pre Chapter 81, SLA 81, et cetera, et cetera. These were all repealed then, mm-hmm, but you're referring to them in the bill as 41.37.
Mm-hmm.
So you're referring to statutes that were repealed. I'm not sure what to do about it. I mean, it just seems awkward to me.
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, that's why we are reestablishing. That's why in the title it says to reestablish.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's because of the sunset dates, you know, it was repealed.
Follow up, Representative Gatto?
Well, I guess I don't really have one. I kind of knew they were repealed. That's why we're reestablishing it. I didn't know if, just to make sure we cross our T's and I's, et cetera, that when we refer to a repeal statute in the bill, is it even legal to refer to a repeal statute which doesn't exist anymore? And I guess if somebody knows that, can you in the bill? I guess you can do anything you want, but do we satisfy some requirements that are out there somewhere by referring to something that's been repealed?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto, in checking with legal, that they said that this is perfectly fine to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. I have a little bit of a question on the sunset and not having a sunset. Do you know how many of the commission, I mean, we're dealing with renewal of commissions all the time, and basically it's for the legislature to take a look and see if they're being effective or not, and kind of hold some feet to the fire instead of having to just go on forever. Is there, do you have any listing of commissions that don't have sunset dates, or is this going to be unique?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Seaton. I do not know of other commissions or boards that don't have sunset dates, but what I am certain of is that the conflicts that we have in Alaska between state land and holders, federal lands, will always be there. It will continue. I mean, if you look at the map right there that shows, you know, federal lands and state lands, it's something that is going to be there forever. We're always going to have them, and we do have the 2009 date coming right at us, you know, as far as the exchange of land and the expedience there, so, you know, the fast track on land exchanges. So it's critical that we do it and that we do it real soon, but as far as having a sunset date, I don't know that your offices, that you could ever anticipate not receiving complaints and phone calls and having a place for the public to go. I can, if you will, an ombudsman for the public is basically what it is.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not thinking of it as a sunset date isn't a, oh, the problem's going to go away. Yeah. The sunset date is, as I've viewed it in the legislature here, as being the legislature has to take a new look at it and say, are these statutes being as effective as they could be,
sure,
and do we need to make some changes? And it forces us to not ignore problems if they're developing. And so it would be helpful if we found out if this is unique, because, like I say, we do some renewals of commissions and boards all the time, and that's our opportunity to to make those changes. So I just, maybe in committee discussion, but I feel much more comfortable if we're having the legislature take a relook at these things we're establishing in a set period of time. Thank you.
Sure. Is that in the form of an amendment?
I thought I would bring it up in case any of the people that are going to testify on the bill might have some issues, and then when we get to committee discussion, I would like to talk about it.
Representative Abel?
Yes, Sue, a couple of questions. I noticed on the fiscal note that it says that the commission was housed in DNR from FY 87 to FY 99. But that on the first page of the bill, under B, it says the commission is an advisory agency of the executive branch of the state, but is not allocated to a principal department. Is that consistent with the earlier intentions of the commission?
Through the chair, Representative Edgeman. It is consistent. What I understood happened in the past was that the commission was under the governor's office and then moved, and perhaps Nico remembers it because Lord knows he's been here longer than me too, but that it was housed in the governor's office and then moved to DNR. I know that it was, their office was physically located in the DNR office in Fairbanks. That's where they worked out of.
On a separate note, Mr. Chairman, back to the issue of composition of the commission and so forth, mm-hmm. According to my notes here, it says the governor appoints 8, the speaker would appoint 2, 2 would be legislators, 2 would be general members of the public, and then the president on the Senate side would appoint accordingly 2 and 2 each. Mm-hmm. But then I go down to qualifications of the members. It says, who are not members of the legislature shall be representative of the diversity of users and uses of federal land in the state. And then that takes me back to Representative Guttenberg's point about how, and that struck me as well, as how the composition, and I know we're dealing back in time and that this doesn't affect or is not anything from the sponsor's point of view, but I'm just sitting here reading this for a second time. wondering in my mind, and then if you go further down, Mr. Chairman, it talks about the various, the governor can appoint for a four-year term, the legislature serves for the person's term of the office as a legislator, and then the member of commission appointed by the member of the legislature serves for 2 years. So you've got a real hodgepodge of appointments and so forth. And I would wonder, I guess, back to the sponsor's representative and maybe for the committee's consideration, whether we might want to think a little bit further about, you know, the composition of this commission and whether we can maybe, you know, for lack of better terms, tighten it up a little bit so that we do have the diversity that the commission, I think, is intended to represent, and that, you know, all of us, we've all served on commissions and boards and whatnot, and continuity is very important and so forth. So it seems to me, just the way it's structured now, again, at first blush, you'd have a lot of people coming and going.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, one thing I would say is that we took the language as it was when it left, when it was repealed, okay? The other thing is that the members of the legislature and our appointments are not overlapping. It's only for your term that that you're there. So, of course, that's going to go. The governor's appointments and the people that we appoint, that the legislature would appoint, making sure and ensuring that we have the diversity, I don't think is, I guess I would not characterize it as a hodgepodge, but a careful consideration that the legislature not serve for longer than they are in office and not have an undue impact on this commission.
Can I do just a quick follow-up? I wouldn't disagree with that, but then if I look at the composition of the members, I don't see one person there from Western Alaska, or I certainly don't see any mm-hmm. anybody there from Southwest Alaska, you know, one of the mm-hmm. larger affected areas of a commission of this nature.
Yeah, I'm guessing this. There are those four other members that and they could be from the two members from the House or the two members from the Senate, plus there are four other members. I agree with you in looking at a roster. Mm-hmm. The members who were selected do not appear to be a good cross-section of the state. I would agree with you. I'm not sure how they arrived at that or if they followed the same guidelines, but it's certainly possible to inadvertently or intentionally or just by chance select members who are willing to serve and seem pretty capable and knowledgeable and experienced and just pick those members. But I'm on your side with regard to making sure that it does ask for a diversity. We'll see if we can get there through this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It does mention on the bottom of page 1, line 14, that it shall represent each judicial district, but I'm not, I can't remember. Some of them are pretty big. So.
Four judicial districts.
It's easy to do
that. Yeah. Any additional questions, Representative Roses?
Just for a point of clarification, on the fourth page where it mentions suit, you had mentioned earlier when I had asked the question about what had transpired since 99 that would need the, and you mentioned that there had been an individual that had filed a lawsuit in order to protect what he saw as his rights. Would reinstatement of this commission then push the burden on the state to file suit on behalf of that individual if they came to the commission and asked the commission to intervene on their behalf and they were not satisfied with the result, and then does it then put the state in a position of being sued by the individual, or does it become the state's responsibility to handle on behalf of the citizens of Alaska?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Roses, the commission has the authority to bring it to the AG, and the state in our Constitution is to protect and defend the Alaska citizens. Now, there are cases that were brought to the AG and brought to, you know, before the court system. I have online with us is Tina Cunning, and she has great detail and knowledge about specifics on your question, but we certainly do grant them the authority because otherwise they're just, they have no teeth. They have no real ability to stand up for the citizens.
I don't think let me restate my question. I don't think do they have the authority. I see that they were given the authority. My concern is, does it then put the total responsibility on the state to file suit on behalf of each of those individuals that feel like they have been disenfranchised? And if the state refuses to then take that suit, does that then put the state in a position of being sued by the individual thinking that they were not taken proper care of? That's the question that I have.
Representative Roses, through the chair, I understand the question. In short answer, I would certainly hope no, but I can understand why you asked that question, and I'm going to defer to Tina and Dell to answer that specifically.
Thank you
for that question.
We do have online Tina Cunning from Fish and Game and Dick Melius from DNR for any questions. Tina, are you online? Obviously.
Yes, sir.
Can you address Representative Roses' question?
In part. In my recollection, there was only one case actually taken up by the AG into the federal court system on behalf of the citizens of Alaska, and that was with regard to cabin regulations adopted by the National Park Service. That's the only time a case could be carried by the state on behalf of citizens would have to meet the criteria of our Department of Law and our Attorney General. So, no, the full burden of representing citizens would not fall to the state.
If I may,
go ahead, please.
The follow-up on that question would be, do you know of any incidences since the commission had been created where individuals that brought cases before the commission that didn't get the kind of result that they thought they had, that either intended or filed any kind of a lawsuit against the state claiming that they didn't represent them adequately?
Negative. Mr. Chairman, I think that overall the commission was largely successful in working cooperatively to resolve issues on behalf of the citizens. It was very effective during its tenure.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. Could you tell me what part of the public, what this process reached out for public process and perhaps had hearings on issues related to the commission that were held in communities that were affected, and how responsive they may or may not have been to those issues from the community?
Is that question directed to me?
Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Do you need to restate it?
I would appreciate that.
In the hearings that the commission held around the state, hopefully they are that they held hearings in affected areas. How responsive was the commission's guidance coming off of those hearings?
Sir, the commission itself was made up of a number of legislators and other appointees, both who had some political influence and those who were representatives of local communities. And so the hearings that were held by the commission helped air a wide range of views. But the real work was done by the executive director and the executive director's staff. Those folks became experts in federal law, regulations, and policies, and were able then to take the information that was gathered through the hearings and provide either avenues for the public and advice for them in seeking resolution, or they worked on the citizens' behalf directly with the respective federal agency to determine why decisions were made the way they were, and if they were inconsistent or believed to be inconsistent with the federal regulations and policies, to try to seek some resolution on those. It was done in a positive manner, not in an adversarial manner. And my recollection is that a lot of those issues that were brought through that format were effectively resolved. There was only one in particular I know that in the end did not reach a positive solution for the communities.
Well, let me get a little bit more specific. On the 1997 annual report that we have, On page 11, when it starts talking about projects and studies, it deals with Denali Park North Access Study. And it says that the commission endorsed the proposal for private construction of a railroad into the northern portion of Denali Park and Preserve. In addition to specifically supporting the railroad, the commission expressed its general support for the concept of northern access into the park. Now, I now represent that area. And I know for a fact, dealing with almost all members of that community, that they have always opposed the railroad. And it's only people from other parts of the state that have supported the railroad. And I see, I just wonder about supporting this commission and having, again, something like that being railroaded over the local wishes of a community. My question is dealing about hearings in local communities and how responsive they were to those people in the community. I certainly in the past see members from Fairbanks on here who might not have represented the interests of the community, but other people in Fairbanks. And I'm just trying to get an understanding how responsive they were to the communities themselves.
From our agency's standpoint, of course, we were only involved with them when the issues involved our agency's responsibilities. So I couldn't provide you a gauge of issues such as that northern access route. In the last years of the commission, they were very poorly funded. And how much they were able to actually conduct hearings in local areas, I'm not certain of.
Thank you.
Representative Steve.
Thank you. And who do we have online? Is it Fish and Game?
We have Fish and Game and DNR.
Oh, okay. I think it's for Fish and Game, and the question that I ask Representative Kelly about the subsistence, first of all, about ADF&G and local advisory boards and how the interaction of that commission was with the local advisory boards we have with ADF&G. And then also, of course, we didn't have federal subsistence boards at that time, or the federal subsistence board local advisory process. How can you explain to me what the workings of that were with ADF&G, but more to the point as far as federal goes, is what you envision as far as the interaction or the overlapping authority of this commission versus the subsistence advisory board? Now, that's the federal subsistence advisory board I'm talking about.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing I have to judge on is based on how the commission operated before it sunsetted or before it was defunded. And the federal subsistence program actually was created in 1990 in the RACs, and the federal board were established in 1992, so they would have had about a five-year overlap before that. But the focus of the commission and its executive director was primarily on federal land management decisions. It was not related to the allocation of fish and wildlife on those lands.
Yes, sir. But within this bill, is that focus going to be totally dependent upon who's the executive director or on the commission's ideas? I mean, it says, we're talking about a diverse group of people, but it seems like one of the most contentious things that we've been dealing with in many areas have been the federal subsistence regulations, and I'm trying to get a feeling whether what we've got is another dual management system starting, or a dual process system where this commission could actually become a competing state agency to the local fish and game advisory board process or the federal subsistence board process. And I don't know the answer because I don't know how those interactions would be, but I don't see anything in the bill that relates to any division of labor there, or if they're intended to be, or could be contemplated to overlap.
Good question.
At this time, I think that I would like to open it up for public testimony. We do have in Fairbanks, Dick Akles, who is, are you prepared to testify, Mr. Akles?
Yes, I am.
Hey, go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, sir, we hear you fine. Thank you.
Okay, I could probably clarify a lot of the questions that have been asked. A little bit about myself. I served as probably the longest member on this commission over the years. The original bill was Betty Fahrenkamp's bill that created this commission. I served 2-year terms over a 15-year period through 4 governors. Our main goal, of course, was the ANILCA process that really altered dramatically the state of Alaska and what the state can do on federal lands here. A lot of concerns that showed up, and the main things that our commission first tackled, we were the ones that filed the lawsuit against the feds on the navigability issue on the rivers here in Alaska, which ultimately gave the state of Alaska the ownership of the riverbeds. And Tina also kind of mentioned the burning in the parks regs, and that eventually extended to Forest Service lands and also BLM lands. There was a concerted effort at that time when these federal agencies took over these new areas that they erased all controversy in their eyes on their management. And if there was cabins that were there that were built that didn't have title to the land, which most of the cabins in Alaska were at that time, but were still being currently used, they were being burnt down. Unfortunately, the Park Service got carried away and burnt down some of Alaska Fish and Game cabins, too, which they had to rebuild. The commission being involved with the subsistence issue, there would be no real overlap there. Our commission was more directed at the broader issues on how things would affect the state of Alaska and how they're going to conduct business on federal lands here after the settlement. Our commission was responsible for overviewing the 72 management plans at that time that were in place, including the 9 major park plans. And the commission has been very diversified, and over the years, especially with the 2-year appointments, the face of the commission changed dramatically during that period of time. Representative Gutenberg's concerns about not having rural representation, matter of fact, I think over half our commission at one time was rural, not urban. And to address the issues, again, on the commission and how it should be set up, I've got a lot of recommendations here. Number one, our commission is not beholden to any agency. That's what caused a problem for our demise. And when we were taken out of OMB in the early days and put into DNR, as the governors came and went, and after commission members, or not commission members, but after the department people or the heads of the department were appointed to the new position, that they felt our commission should probably abide by their wishes. That caused problems. We were the only commission also that could file lawsuits. We were attached or parallel to the Land Use Council at that time, which became very ineffective. And of the 28 members of the Land Use Council, which served from the public like our commission does, they became very frustrated. They had no way of backing up anything on their recommendations with any type of legislation to stop things from happening. And because of that, became very frustrated. And Vern Wiggins himself, basically at that time with the Land Use Council, kind of joined our two commissions together so they could utilize at least our entity in cases that affected a large public entity, otherwise more than one person. Some of these management plans affected several hundred people. And then that's when the actions were finally brought legally to challenge what the feds were doing. the importance of this commission. Another thing about the funding, that was one of the most frustrating things that I think I had to put up with. In the 15 years I served on this commission was the funding. Every year we had to go down to Juneau and lobby for our funding because once we got attached to DNR, our funding was zeroed out every spring or every fiscal year. And we had, if it wasn't for Ramona Barnes and Rick Halford and some of the other people down there at that time, the commission probably would have died on the vine from lack of funding. Initially started out in 1981 with about a $530,000 budget. That's when Robin Foster at that time was executive director. Stan Leapart, I believe, was appointed as executive director around 1984, I believe. From that point on, our funding started to deteriorate. And once the office got down to less than $200,000 a year, it became such an overwhelming burden to look at all the federal registers that are coming in all the time, all the federal changes on the lands up here, which ultimately would affect all user groups, not any, but all, that was doing any or conducting any type of business or livelihood on federal lands. It became such an overwhelming thing that I even would go down and donate sometimes 10 to 15 hours a week helping Stan out in the office. The importance of this commission, in my eyes, is vital. We're not just looking at just certain usury groups and how it will affect certain usury groups. What we're looking at here is what the state's going to do in the future. We have a lot of PLOs, public land orders, that are still in effect in Alaska right now, several hundreds of them, they're obsolete. They should have been sunsetted years ago. They were all temporary. One of them was to create the pipeline corridor, for example. Above the Yukon River to Attigan, that corridor is still 10 miles wide. It's got a very vital impact what's going to happen in the future of Alaska, because right now all that highway is the Dalton Highway, which the state doesn't own one inch yet in that area, because the original public land order 5150 that was put on that corridor basically to establish where the pipeline is going to be withdrew all that land from all use. On top of it today, the state selected. But on top of the state selection are other public land orders waiting to fall in place. And if the state ever does get the highway and the roadbed, it's vital that it gets the waysides. And the waysides, in this particular context, is the inner corridor. If it doesn't get the inner corridor, it's going to be in court forever, because anything above the Yukon River off that highway, which is the only one, will have to go to court on any type of access issue to native lands, state lands, or private lands off that corridor. That's why the RS-2477 issue became such an important thing. But it could have been moot. That last lawsuit that the state won here 4 days ago would have been a moot thing from Coldfoot to Chandler if the state could have got that public land order finally lifted, because they know where they're going to put that pipe. Which is the average width of the pipeline is 190 feet. It's 10 miles wide up there. And it's the inner and outer corridor there. And if the inner corridor does not go to the state, the public land order above what the state has to select on that's going to fall down and create a new CSU, a conservation system unit. What that does is change the designation of the lands and the inholders in that area, and it's going to be impacted greatly in that area if that does happen, because the state will be in the court for the rest of its life. Trying to figure things out as far as access and inholder rights. That's just one of a myriad of things that this commission handled. And because of that, the commission's funding becomes the most important thing. It's going to have to be a block time of 5 to 10 years or indefinite. It's going to have to come out of a place where we're not beholden to anybody's feelings that we're going to be doing things that they want at that time, like DNR or Fish and Game or anybody else. If it was based out of OMB, it was also the understanding that as governors change, the commission's directions of what they do does not change. So I can see just by listening here the fears of certain people, how they view what this commission may do or interfere with. We will not interfere with subsistence. But if subsistence starts including navigability, the riverbeds, I think the commission would be, but other than that, it would not. There's our commission was basically on the more broad issues of what's going to be affecting the state in the future. And after this 2009 fast track bill that was just mentioned, things are really going to change up here. And the state of Alaska is going to be living on 109 or 104 million acres only, and won't have access to a lot of federal areas, because there's a lot of federal things going to happen here as soon as this date's passed, and that's new conservation system units, CSUs, and all the laws. Just taking a land mass and creating a recreation area will limit totally what the state will do in that area, and the inholders that are also associated with that area.
Mr. Eccles, could I get you to focus a little more on the need and an effort to expedite this? If you have anything in writing, I'd like to submit it. But if we could get some closing remarks, I'd like to move on if we could.
Sure. Instead of saying too much more, I could answer questions probably a lot quicker to clarify anybody's issues on how the commission operates. The AG's office is a very important thing, and we've always had a person from the AG's office that attended all of our meetings.
Okay, thank you. I think we do have Ricky Geese on from Kenai. Ricky, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Could I, just for the knowledge of the committee, I intend to hold this bill over, but I would like to get public testimony. We do have another bill that we'd like to hear today. If you would like to wait for a next committee meeting to testify, that would be acceptable, but I know that you've come to the LIO and certainly don't want that trip to be for nothing. So if you'd like to make a few brief comments or wait until next time, I would entertain some brief comments now, or if whatever your choice would be there.
Okay, I'll make my comments brief. I just, for the record, my name is Ricky Geese. I live in Kenai, Alaska. Currently, I serve as the executive director of Kenai River Sport Fishing Association. Prior to that, I was the director of the Kenai Convention and Visitor Bureau Association. I would just like to echo the comments that I when I first started my job, we interacted on conservation issues on the Kenai River. The Kenai Peninsula were a mixture of federal and state lands and private properties. And as I get more and more involved in this process, I would wholeheartedly agree that it is very important for there to be a commission such as this that is looking specifically at federal, state, regulations and making sure that the regulations that are passed on the federal level are being adhered to by the management agencies that are set out to do that. I have found at times there are inconsistencies in that approach. For example, on some of the subsistence issues, the state has been filing requests for reconsideration on policies and procedures. The Secretary of Interior has directed the Federal Subsistence Board to set up policies and procedures, yet those have not been followed, and there's great concern that that there are inconsistencies that are not being they're not being consistent in their approaches. So the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council also has federal jurisdiction, but there is interactions between the Board of Fisheries and the council on the efforts to privatize many of our coastal fisheries, and it would be nice if people did have feelings that they could go someplace where those feelings could be heard and those issues be researched. I also think that on the peninsula there are a lot of land use issues that are going to be coming up, and I wholeheartedly support such a commission. Thank you.
Any questions for any of the testifiers? With that, is there anyone in the audience who hasn't signed up that would like to testify? Okay. With that, and with the permission of the committee, I'd like to hold this over. I think there's some questions. Sue, I'd encourage you to get with Representative Edgman, some of the other people that have questions, Representative Roses, and work some of this out, and we'll get this rescheduled at the at our earliest convenience.
Could we also include in that, because Mr. Eccles had testified, said that back in 1999 when this was
the decommission occurred, I'll refer to it as that, that one of the concerns he had is that the budget had fallen to $200,000, which he felt made it very ineffective. So one of the concerns that I would have, since this shows an undetermined fiscal note, I'd like to know at least some kind of a round figures what they anticipate would make this a viable committee or commission. I don't see any reason to create one if you're going to hamstring them by not giving them the money. And if we don't know what it costs, I don't believe in signing a blank check either. So I realize it's an indeterminate amount if you don't know how many lawsuits you're going to have to bring forward on behalf of citizens. But at least in those items where you know there's a fiscal note and what could be assessed, I think we'd need that. And I would also like to have somebody get a legal opinion on the question that I asked before about what kind of position this puts the state in the event that somebody brings a concern forward. And if the state chooses not to file suit, then what position have we put the state in terms of that citizen then wanting to take an action against the commission because they felt like they did not serve their purpose in filing that suit? So I'd like to have a legal opinion as to what kind of adverse position we could be putting the state in as a result of creating this commission again, if any.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the same note, perhaps on that same indeterminate fiscal note, perhaps we could get a funding history when it was in place from the different agencies.
One thing at this point, I think I will share a little of my philosophy on fiscal notes and cost. As a lot of you know, and some of us new people are not as aware of, our finance committee is very skilled at taking apart, and they have expertise that we may not have. So I'm very comfortable with the legal opinion. I think unless there's something that just causes a committee member terrible grief, that I don't have a large problem with moving a bill that's got fiscal notes that will be addressed in the finance committee. I think they have expertise that we may not deal with, and I'd like to deal primarily with the resource side of it. I don't want to limit any debate on any bill for any reason, and if it becomes an issue, I certainly want to address it. But my overriding philosophy is let's deal with the resource aspect of the bills, and unless we have a terrible grief, move it to the next committee and let them deal with the financial aspect. So, but I do agree with the legal opinion. And with that, I'm going to, unless any member has objection, I'm going to set this aside and move on to the next bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Next before us is HB, get my glasses on, 25. and I understand that Representative Seaton is going to move to the other side of the desk and present this bill. Welcome, sir. It's been a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. And I would like to, first of all, I am Representative Seaton, House District 35 for the record, and I have with me my staff member, Katie Schaus. If she could join me up here at the table if there's any questions. Here we go. There's been a problem in Alaska as we urbanize and as we grow, and even in rural areas, as we become a much more litigious society, of recreational use and the restriction of recreational use, because people fear that if someone's on their land and gets hurt, they'll get sued. The whole impetus between this is to allow people that own land much more comfort in allowing free public use of their land for recreation. And so that's the entire intent of this bill. The bill does that by changing the duty that a landowner owes for allowing someone to use their land. That's a duty of care. What it does basically is it changes the standard from simple negligence, which can be anything from letting a skier go across your land and there's a stump and they hit the stump and then they sue you because, oh, you were negligent because you didn't cut that off within 6 inches of the ground, to someone going into a hay field and, you know, falling down. So that's the intent of this bill, and what it does, it raises a standard of care to gives immunity unless there's gross negligence, intentional misconduct, or let's see, what's the other one?
Recklessness.
Yeah, reckless endangerment. And so what that does is gives people comfort to let free public use of their land, and it encourages hiking trails, snow machiners. We have people, as you'll probably hear, I think there are probably people online from the Matsu and Fairbanks that want a snow machine in areas, but you know, landowners want to say, oh, we don't want to let snow machines go across our land because, you know, what happens if they have an accident? And so this also takes care of it, so it doesn't have to be explicit. If you don't prevent somebody from using your land, that's implicitly letting them use it for free for recreation, and therefore they're covered. You could not, of course, take a piece of barbed wire and run it across the trail. That would be, you know, you would not get immunity under this bill. The way Alaska has handled immunity for recreational uses in two ways. One of those has been the easements, trail easements, but those are limited to 50 feet wide, and if it's over 50 feet wide, you have no immunity. So there's also a problem of those easements have to be picked up by the state or by the municipal government. State and municipal governments are reticent to do that. There's surveying costs and all those things. So this is the intent of this is to make it much more flexible, easy. And again, this is free public use. If someone charges a fee, this bill does not cover them. There's another bill that is an Alaska statute that does give some protections for people that are operating commercial ski slopes and those kind of things, but this bill would not cover anyone that's doing that. It also does not cover municipalities or governments. What we did was we found out that if you did that with municipalities all of a sudden or governments, what would happen is, you know, nobody has to maintain their playgrounds or anything else. So that's not the intent at all. Again, it's free public use for recreational activity. And the other thing this does, it sets out and gives some security to the landowner that by providing that free public use, no one can claim by that use adverse possession of your land. In other words, if somebody's using the land and then they come in and file, well, I own this land because I've been using it. This bill specifically says that for this free recreational use, you cannot gain a prescriptive easement or adverse possession. So it protects the landowner in that way. I think that you've got quite a bit of material in here in your packet. You also have a breakdown of a number of pages so you can see what's happening in other states, and you can see that this is consistent with what many other states do. They don't have a duty to warn or a duty to care, those kind of things, and that's what this removes and makes clear. In our current system, it is very unclear as to where you're protected and where you're not. And so this clarifies that throughout. You have legal opinions on in your packet as well, and letters of support from around the state. And Mr. Chairman, I can go through the bill in more detail, or we've got it there. I would mention, and not mentioning specifically for another bill, but this committee did consider this bill last year. New members, everybody needs to consider the bill again. It did pass through the House last year unanimously. So, and the bill is unchanged from that time. But, I mean, this is a new committee and needs to consider all the ramifications.
I understand it on the floor, that would be inappropriate, but I don't think that's bad for the new members, especially to hear. Thank you. Questions, Representative Gooden?
Thank you. Well, you answered my first question. It's basically the same. It is the same of what was last year. On the first page, line 9, the end of a landowner may directly or indirectly. Are you satisfied that covers all those range of things that you allow them to and that you don't allow them to and that you don't really know, even if you don't know that's indirectly? It covers all the range of things that you're looking for, that the legal department has encompassed all those things adequately?
Well, I think so. Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think it does. If it said you have to give permission, then we would have a problem because it was a permission slip. But where it's direct or indirect, I feel pretty confident that indirect means that you didn't go out and prevent somebody from coming on your land, so that's indirect permission that they can.
Representative Gatto.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. The question is, you post it with no trespassing signs, you fence it, and then you stand in front of it and guard it, and people still enter upon the land and go turn a switch on a piece of equipment, stick their hand in it, and hurt themselves. Worst possible scenario. Under existing statutes, do you know where the homeowner, because I'm thinking that under existing statutes, the homeowner is probably going to get sued. Am I correct?
The legal liability is very murky. There's a statute that allows for, trying to remember what the name of it is right now, but anyway, it allows for unimproved land. But if you have a hay field, the question is that improved land or not? If it's, how close to a building does it have to be for unimproved land? There's an unimproved land statute that provides some immunity, but the question becomes, hey, if there's a trail across it, if it's been a hay field, if it's been, how close to a building does it have to be unimproved land? And that's a very murky legal question, and that's what this attempts to solve. So under the existing law, even under this law, you can get sued. It's just that statutorily we're saying the suit has to be for gross negligence, reckless, or intentional conduct. So this doesn't mean that somebody can't sue you. It just means that they're going to have to prove these things instead of simple negligence.
Representative Dotto.
Thank you. I'm going to call my follow-up firewood and potatoes. We have potato fields where they harvest potatoes and then allow people to go through with a bag, $5 a bag, take all the potatoes you can fit in the bag. Is this charging? And then point number two, if you allow people to cut firewood and you charge them for firewood, is that charging? And I know that has been referenced in some other states, and I want to ensure that we get on the record what our thoughts are on those two activities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gatto. If you look on page 2, starting on line 22, charge is identified and means a fee or admission price imposed for access or for the use of the land, recreational service, entertainment, or other activity, except in these following, are not considered a charge. So consideration received by a landowner from state political subdivision for land leased for or dedicated to that political subdivision. Property tax relief is not. An in-kind contribution or service, such as improving a trail or something like that, if all of that is used for improving the access to trails or remedy or reduce or improve a hazard. So under the scenario that you set out where you charge somebody to come get potatoes, that is not going to be considered recreational use. This does not give them immunity. This is only for private land, only for free public use.
Just for clarity, then the person picking potatoes can legally sue, and there's nothing in the statute that says picking potatoes excludes you from suing.
Through the chair, that's correct. This bill deals solely with recreational use and raising the standard under which a suit could take place or a suit would be effective. But a commercial venture where you're having someone on your land or under totally different statutes than are covered under this free public use statute.
Thank you.
Additional questions for the representative? At this time, I'd like to take public testimony. I will point out that it is my intention to move this bill today, so your public testimony is welcome, but do keep that in mind. And if we could keep it as brief as possible,
certainly under 5 minutes. That would be greatly appreciated. First of all, let's go to Homer. Is Dave Brand, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What would you like to say to the committee?
Hey, first of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you on House Bill 25. I'm a volunteer trails construction maintenance volunteer for over 30 years in Alaska, so I'm well versed in trail development problems and so on. And one of the biggest deterrents to the development of recreational trails, besides money, has been the reluctance of private landowners to allow trails to cross their property, mainly because of the concerns about liability. And the existing state statutes that the state has have quite a bit of confusing language, and there's not just one statute, there's two or three that relate to different aspects. And so I really support House Bill 25 in its simplicity, in its clarity, and what it does to encourage private landowners to allow recreational use. I'm a board member and an active member of the local ski club here, which represents approximately 300 people, and many of our trails in our 30 miles, 50 kilometers of trails cross private land. And so far, it's because those people have been willing to take a risk and allow ski trails across their property. But passing the statute would make it much easier and make them much more willing to allow permanent trail access, permanent easements across their property. Mr. Seaton has already talked about how it's similar to a number of other states, and other people have seen this as a real win-win situation, and I would encourage you to go ahead and support this bill and pass it out. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Braun. Karen Noyes, are you there?
Yes. My name is Karen Noyes. I'm the conservation director for Kedgemack Heritage Land Trust, and I'd like to express strong support for this House Bill 25. Kedgemack Heritage Land Trust works on trails issues and access for the public in general across the Kenai Peninsula. Private landowners, as Dave mentioned, are often concerned about liability involved in allowing the public to access their land, and yet these land owners do support trail development and use. If we can decrease the liability to landowners, we can create a more comprehensive trail network and can enhance the recreational opportunities for both our visitors and residents. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions of anyone? And do jump in if you have questions for anyone that's testifying. I want to try to move this through this as quickly as we can. Is Lindsay Winkler, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Please go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Lindsay Winkler. Resource Committee members, thanks for having us here today. I am representing the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and I would just like to reiterate our support for this bill. Last year, when this was initially going through, all 11 districts in the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts supported this bill, and that's from Delta down to Kodiak. And our support for this bill is driven by the clarity that it provides to all the landowners and the standard language that's used across the country, and the fact that it doesn't threaten a landowner's property rights because it specifically states that this informal, non-commercial use does not constitute a basis for a prescriptive easement. As you know, the support for this bill is very strong and diverse, from snow machine clubs on the Kenai and Mat-Su to the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce to individual landowners who want to allow their neighbors to hunt on their land. I think we should give these landowners the ability to understand their rights and responsibilities, and passing House Bill 25 will provide Alaskans with the peace of mind that we all deserve. Thank you.
Thank you. In fairness to a geographic deference, I would like to go to Anchorage. Jack Mosby, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. I'm past president of Alaska Trails, which is a statewide trails nonprofit. We were established in 2003, and it's run by an all-volunteer group. The past 2 years, we have been doing a variety of trail trainings across the state. And this last year, we did 4 introductory classes to sustainable trails, as well as several international mountain biking training classes in 2004 and 2005. The number one issue that was raised in all of those classes was liability. We would wholeheartedly support the passage of HB 25, and we'll continue to work towards that effort in any way that we can. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to go to Anchorage. Ricky, are you, or I'm sorry, Kenai. Ricky, are you still there? Ricky Geese?
Yes, I am.
Please go ahead.
Yes, our organization supports HB 25. I just had a couple questions for the sponsor. One was on page 3, where we're talking about recreational activity on the Kenai Peninsula. I mean, on the Kenai River here, we have much recreational activity, but on the lower stretches of our river, we also have personal use, and there's also subsistence uses. With the definition of recreational activity, in your opinion, my question would be, does that encompass personal use and subsistence uses? And then the second question I had from a commercial operator here is that they run a commercial operation, a restaurant, along the Kenai River. However, they do have riverfront property that on the front of their property along the river that does not have commercial uses, but they're the landowner there. They would like people to be able, it's there's different private property landowners lined up there, and they would like to coordinate together for infrastructure to allow walkways along the river that the public could access free of charge. However, there is a commercial operation on the property. So it's a mixture of a commercial operator, a private landowner, and if they would, my question would be as clarification, is if there was a connected walkway between these different users, different property owners, would that stay still hold for the, even though there's a commercial use on the property, the section that does not have a commercial use, would this bill cover them?
Ricky, I'm going to ask you to, I appreciate your testimony, but I'm going to ask you to direct that to the Office of Representative Seaton for clarification, and at this point, we're going to move on with public testimony.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Back to Homer. Is Anne Marie Holland in?
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Anne Marie Holland, and I work for the City of Homer as an assistant to the city manager. I'm here today on behalf of the city manager, Walt Reedy, who is in Juneau this week attending other meetings. In 2006, the Homer City Council voiced its strong support for House Bill 415, and we are pleased that Representative Seaton has reintroduced that legislation as House Bill 25 this session. We hope this time that the bill will be judged on its merits in every committee hearing and pass easily. Outdoor recreation is an important part of Homer's identity and the local economy. Most Homer area residents support trails development, but some landowners who would be interested in establishing public trails through their property are understandably nervous about possible liability. House Bill 25 addresses these concerns in a straightforward manner, just as many other states have done. It clears up ambiguity in existing state statute, which is a worthwhile goal in itself. It provides protection for well-meaning landowners without offering protection to those who are reckless or grossly negligent. From our perspective, it provides a common sense solution for everyone involved and helps promote activity that is healthy, wholesome, and at the heart of what makes Alaska the great land. We urge your support for this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Julia Ingebretson?
Yes, thank you for your time. My name is Julie Ingebretson. I'm a Kenai Peninsula Borough resident. I live in the unincorporated community of Anchor Point. I support House Bill 25. We need a way for property owners to allow recreation on their lands without undue liability. The Kenai Peninsula Borough does not have trails powers and cannot accept trail easements. So in unincorporated areas, the state is the only entity that can accept easements. This is a very cumbersome process, and this takes a lot of time and costs the state a lot of money. I feel as a citizen of the borough, it's reasonable for state law to protect private property owners. It's also reasonable for the state to support active citizens. We have an increasing rate of obesity and diabetes, and it's important to encourage an active lifestyle from hiking, skiing, mushing, recreational vehicles, and the list goes on. I feel it's important to protect our quality of life, and it's reasonable for the state to provide protections for property owners that allow for recreational use in a clear manner. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Julie. Millie Martin, are you there?
Yes, this is Millie Martin. And, of course, I concur with what has been said up to now, and I'm not going to repeat that. I do want to advise, however, that there will be another resolution coming before the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly, again in support, just as we did last year at House Bill 415. There will be a resolution, it should be very similar, if not a carbon copy, of the previous resolution, and be coming before the Assembly on February the 6th. I am one of the private property owners that is looking at wanting to designate ski trails across my land. And right now, with the way it is written in statute, I do not feel like I have adequate protection. As was noted before, easements as they are now are only a 50-foot width. No one stays within that 50-foot distance, and it's very, very easy to come off of that. So therefore, I don't feel I have that protection. In addition, Alaska Statute 0965-200 currently gives tort immunity only if the land is unimproved. And that did prove to be a conundrum to the University of Alaska in litigation, where the court found the issue concerned improved property. In that case, it happened to be a sledding hill, and therefore denied the immunity to the university under the current statute. And I think that's really, really important. I truly appreciate Representative Seaton bringing this forward again, and I also appreciate, Representative Johnson, your intention to move this forward. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah.
Question for Representative Gatto.
Is it Roberta?
No, this was
Millie.
No, Millie Martin is who that was.
Millie, are you still there?
I am, yes.
Mr. Representative Gatto, I was interested in something you said, a sledding hill.
Yes.
Very often, there's nothing about a sledding hill that's improved. People just slide down on top of the snow. And yet this was an issue that a court ruled that this construed that the property had been improved. But there's some other
things. That is correct, and that's my concern, and one of the reasons I really appreciate this bill, because I would consider any kind of an improved ski trail an improvement. And if the court would consider that sledding hill an improvement, I know they would consider a ski trail that.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Roberta Hyland, are you there?
Yes. My name's Roberta Hyland, and I, too, strongly support House Bill 25 and appreciate so much it getting passed out. But I also would like to ask all of you to please do anything in the future to help this bill along. And we, my husband and I, are also people who allow people to come on our land to use the trails, and this bill would certainly relieve us of our concerns of the litigation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Is there anyone that I missed off net? Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? With that, I'd like to close public testimony. Do you have something, sir? Would you come up and sit down and state your name? And
I missed the comment period for House Bill 87.
Yes, you did.
It
will be back before us. And we did not close public comment on that, so that'll be available at a future date. Thank you. Is there anyone else to comment on HB 25? With that, I'd like to close public testimony, which I probably just did a while ago. Any questions or comments of the sponsor, Representative Roses?
No, it's not a question or comment, but I wanted to put it on the record that I do own some recreational property in Kachemak Bay, and whether the chair determines that I have a conflict of interest, I'd like to know. So, before I cast any votes.
I object.
Just wanted it on the record.
Absolutely, I appreciate that.
It certainly gets used lots without my permission.
Yeah, any additional questions or comments?
Yeah, I'll make one.
Okay.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, just the experience I had, I have reasonable amount of property, and a running club asked if they could use my property for a race. That involved them running down a hay field and then down an embankment where the hay field ended and onto a gravel road. And of course I said, oh yeah, no problem. And I realized at this meeting what a risk that was. And I would like to be able to say, yeah, no problem, and not have anything other than no problem. So I'll be voting in favor of this.
You could have owned a cross-country team and not even know it.
You could have owned me.
Any additional questions? What is the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you ready for a motion?
I would entertain a motion.
Okay, I move House Bill number 25, Version A, with it accompanying a zero fiscal note out of committee.
Any objections? Indeterminate fiscal notes? Or no, yeah. Zero fiscal notes.
Yeah.
Any objections? So ordered. With that, I think the first meeting is over. I do want to remind everyone that to help out my staff, that you not leave the committee room until you sign the committee report. And with
I'd like
that,
to have experience.
I've chased down members myself. With that, it's 2:30, and I would like to adjourn this meeting. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate it.